Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
For most of the stressful situations in our lives, it's our perception of a situation more than the situation itself. But turn that around, and what about its opposite? Physiologically, the opposite of stress is kindness. It's how kindness feels. Some psychologists refer to it as elevation. Kindness feels like an elevated state. You help someone, it feels satisfying and it feels nice. If you observe an act of kindness, sometimes you feel moved or inspired. But globally, those are referred to similarly as elevation.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, the show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. My name is Dr. Rupi. I'm a medical doctor. I also study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me on this podcast where we explore multiple determinants of what allows you to live your best life. And remember, you can sign up to thedoctorskitchen.com for the newsletter where we give weekly recipes plus tips and hacks on how to improve your lifestyle today. My guest today is David Hamilton, PhD. He is a writer, columnist, speaker, and author of 10 books covering the science of kindness, self-esteem, and the mind-body connection. He is pretty much the kindness czar and has been featured on Channel 4's Sunday Brunch Live in the UK and CBS Sunday Morning in the US. And in today's podcast, we talk broadly about the subjects of kindness, self-esteem, and mind-body medicine, as well as his personal journey from organic chemist at a well-known pharmaceutical company to now having the courage and confidence to preach what he practices. We have a really down-to-earth, authentic conversation. Perhaps the second part of the conversation is my favorite, because we really dive into what he's thinking about doing next and how that's conjuring up a bit of nervous energy, which hopefully will be converted into something positive. But earlier on, we talk about the placebo effect, how to cultivate inner self-confidence and esteem, manifesting physical changes in the body with brain visualization and mental exercise is something that I probably would have scoffed at about 5 or 6 years ago. But now I'm really understanding a lot more about the research and the science behind. We talk about the antidote to stress hormones and the kindness hormone, oxytocin, the virality of kindness, the difference between toxic positivity and actually empathizing when in a bad situation, as well as kindness and positivity as a muscle that needs to be worked out. You can find my guest at www.drdavidhamilton.com and also check out the links, all of which are on the show notes, thedoctorskitchen.com/podcast, and check out some of the visuals that we put on social media as well, some little sound bites that I think really resonated with myself. But for now, it's a bit of a long podcast. I hope you enjoy it, and I will sum up some of the most impactful tips that David gave me that I'm personally going to be putting into practice at the end of the show. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you, David, because this is a subject I don't think I've typically paid enough attention to over the years. My primary focus has obviously been medicine, that I've been practicing for the last 10 years, coupled with nutrition and lifestyle. And the sort of the clinical research behind the ingredients and recipes and how that pertains to physiological changes in the body. But I was really interested to hear about A, your background in organic chemistry and pharmaceuticals initially, and how you've transitioned the whole way along to what you practice now, which is all about kindness, self-love, and gratitude. And actually, to be fair to myself, I did practice, well, I still practice gratitude, and I have done for a number of years, where I share three things I'm grateful for every single day for, I think it was almost 3 years, on social media. But I'd love to for you to take us on that journey of how you got to what you're doing right now.
At university, I did a chemistry, a specialised in biological and medicinal chemistry in my honours year. And then I did my PhD was organic chemistry. And then I went to work with AstraZeneca. And I was an organic chemist there. And but what intrigued me, I was working really in drug development. So I had a very broad role, you know, that spanned. It was in some ways a kind of chemistry stroke communication role. It was a new type of role that they'd created in AstraZeneca the previous year to I joined that spanned a number of different areas. And it needed organic chemists who could speak the language of people doing hard lab chemistry, but it could also speak the language of people developing the medicines and really span the area, with the idea being to speed up the rate that things are done. So that job exposed me to clinical trial data that I maybe wouldn't have seen in a slightly different role. And I found that fascinating because as well as I loved the science, I loved, you know, the building of the drugs, and I loved the whole, you know, the formulation side. I loved all of that kind of stuff and the analytical side of it. But once I saw the results of the clinical trials, that just, you know, the idea that of the placebo effect, that people could be improving because they believe that this sugar pill, i.e. the placebo, the sugar pill, was going to help them. And so people would show some improvement. And I think the roots of my fascination with that was because my mum, when I was young, had postnatal depression or postpartum depression after my youngest sister was born. And so my youngest sister was born in the mid-70s. And I remember my mum had been ill on and off, but as a child, you don't know why. You know, my mum didn't really tell us too much about it. Obviously, she's trying to protect us. There was four children, really. And I remember I knew my mum was sick and I wanted to help her. And the English teacher had taken us to the library when I just started high school. And I was 11 years old. And this is going to sound really corny, but a book fell off the shelf. Now, I might have bumped it with my bag or something, but it's called The Magic Power of Your Mind by a gentleman called Walter Germain. And I had this instinct, I bet that can help my mum. And so I just put it in my bag and took it. I didn't know you're supposed to join a library, you know, and get a wee yellow card. First time I'd been in one. So I put it in my bag. I thought, oh, that's great. I'll borrow that. And you know, my mum, we've still got it, by the way.
Really?
I forgot to take it back because it was so, my mum devoured it. You know, it didn't cure depression, of course. But what it did is it taught her strategies like what we now call meditation, mindfulness and gratitude. And it taught her things like that, that could help her to navigate a course through some of the difficult times. And it certainly made an improvement for my mum. So one of the things she did was affirmations, and she used to pump her fist and go, it's all in the mind of a matter, I can do it kind of thing. And that was an energizing body language kind of thing that she did. And so wind the clock forward, and my mum and I had all these conversations about the mind while I was growing up as a teenager, then in my early 20s. So wind the clock forward, here I am working with AstraZeneca and I'm looking at clinical trial data, and all my friends and colleagues are so excited that this cardiovascular drug, I worked mostly cardiovascular, a little bit of cancer as well, and they're looking at this cardiovascular blood pressure lowering drug, and they're thinking, wow, look how great it is. And all I can see is how many people had improved in the placebo. And I wanted to know why. So I, in my spare time, I began to research and investigate what is that bridge between your thinking, your believing and your feeling and the brain and the body. And so I found so much information on that, that that became, I knew in my heart, this is what I want to do. I want to educate people on how mind and emotions can actually not just have a detrimental effect in terms of stress, but how they could have a positive effect if we could harness different mental and emotional states. So I decided after 4 years that this is what, it was such a pull in me that this is what I believe I wanted to do. I wanted to teach and I wanted to write. And so I just decided one day to leave the job and dive into what I do now.
I mean, that's incredible because you're giving up quite an incredible job at one of the world's biggest pharma companies where you're a prized asset and you're sort of, I mean, it's really entrepreneurial because you're literally building your own path. I mean, where did you start on that like newfound journey?
By taking a big dive down the way. It was one of these instances that it seemed like a good idea at the time. But I had absolutely no idea how to do it. I remember I had to work, because of the level of my job, I had to work 3 months notice period as a kind of handover of projects and stuff. And I was all pumped up initially. I remember about 6 weeks into it, I woke up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing? I'm leaving a really well-paid job, fantastic career prospects, and I'm going to write. I failed my English at school. What am I doing? And I'm going to be a public speaker. Speaking in front of people frightens the life out of me. What am I doing? You know, and what I really, what I found difficult, I was completely broke within a year. Partly because I had no idea how to start this new career. I didn't know how. I'd gone from the safety of high school right into university. I literally finished my degree and was hired by one of the really well-known professors in the department to work the summer. And I literally finished with him on a Friday, working a summer job, a research job, and then started my PhD on the Monday. I finished my PhD 3 years later on a Friday, started work with AstraZeneca the following Wednesday. I'd never been in the world. I didn't know what it was like to actually... You know, if I worked at AstraZeneca, I need something done. I go to human resources and it's sorted for me. Now, you know, how do you book a room to do a talk and how do you advertise it? So nobody came to my events. And God, plus, actually, I so lacked confidence. I always knew that I'd struggled with confidence, which is actually rooted in low self-esteem that I struggled with for years. But I didn't realise how chronic it was until I actually had to go out in the world and do things for myself. And so I struggled with advertising myself and putting myself out there, which contributed to the reality of the fact that within a year I was absolutely broke. I mean, literally.
Wow.
And then I moved sideways. Some friends and I set up an international relief charity called Spirit Aid Foundation, and I ran that as director for a couple of years. And I think that was my growing up period where I had to, but now I had the support of a group of friends who were running this charity, and we had to, you know, really borrow and beg and all that to, because we had no money initially to start. And so that period of growing up for me was with the support, rather than being on my own, I was with the support of friends making my way in the world, all in a similar kind of position. And that is, I think I needed that kind of 2 year period, really.
That's amazing. I mean, like it must have been such a strong will and pull for you to leave that position and then grow up in the world. And you know, there's so many parallels between what you've just talked about and medicine, because when you start as a young, naive 18-year-old who just wants to save lives and save the world, you enter into this sort of fraternity, if you like, where you are mollycoddled all the way up to junior doctor level, and then you go up the ranks and it's very clear the path ahead of you. And to step outside of that, whether it be, you know, a different specialty, whether it be nutrition, whether it be leaving the specialty altogether, or the industry altogether, you know, it's very, very hard to do. And you've actually got to have a lot of confidence and self-belief. And it's quite interesting to note that you struggle with self-esteem, because you don't appear to be someone who lacks self-esteem. I wonder if we could double click on that.
Yeah, well, actually, that's often the case with a lot of people who struggle with self-esteem. You can't really tell. You know, I think, you know, I wrote a book on this a few years ago because I knew I needed to work on it myself. It was beginning to have really, really harmful consequences in a number of areas of my life. And one of the things that I discovered early on in that is there's two types of self-esteem, and we often get it back to front. There's external self-esteem, which is where you derive your sense of worthiness and value, if you will, from successes and achievements in life, and maybe people having positive perceptions and opinions of you. And that can feel good. And as long as you're extracting that from the outside world all the time, then you can appear outwardly quite happy. But that's not really healthy. As they say in Scotland, your coat is in a shaky nail, meaning, you know, all it takes is for a couple of things to go wrong, a couple of bad reviews, change in perception. It's devastating. So what the other type of self-esteem, which is more like what you might call self-love, stroke self-compassion, is an inner sense of your own worthiness and value. And that inner sense is not dependent upon successes and achievements and people liking you and having good opinions and perceptions and having nice reviews. It doesn't mean that you don't want those things. Of course, that's human nature. You naturally want to achieve and interact and have that. But it just means that your sense of worthiness deep in your heart and your soul, if you will, is not rested upon those things. So if something in the external world changes, yes, it can sting a little bit, but you've got this inner resilience, like a deep sense of worthiness and support that knows that, you know, no matter what, I'm still here. I've got this. Mm. It's like an inner resource that almost kind of buffers some of the winds and the storms from the outside world if they emerge in your life. And I swiftly realized that I had a fair bit of the former, the external self-esteem that made me seem to people outwardly happy. But on the inside, I struggled a lot of the time because I had almost zero of the inner and stuff. Mm. And so oftentimes in my quiet moments, I would be really struggling. And then I was like a yo-yo kind of thing. Like sometimes I'd be really happy to be in certain places, but other times I was trying to avoid places and people because I got this wee resurgence of the lack of inner sense of worthiness and value. And I found myself pulling away from situations and people. And so I would have this kind of little wave motion where sometimes I was there and sometimes I was not, but nobody notices when you're not, kind of thing. But it was really interfering a lot in my sense of happiness and, you know, life itself and almost every area of my life. And so I had to deal with it, really.
This is quite interesting because it's almost like a parallel with celebrities or those in the public eye, because they constantly have to be on, they constantly have to demonstrate whatever that persona is, whether it's them being loud or funny. Comedians are perhaps some of the worst of it, but it's almost like we all need to build up this inner sense of worthiness, because in a sense social media has made us all celebrities. Every single one of us. We all have photos of us in digital media. We are all validated or criticized via comments and likes and engagements. And building up that self-confidence has never been so important. And I wonder if there are some ways in which you can share that perhaps listeners could utilize to build up that. Because, I mean, I'm certainly lacking in those myself, not to turn this into a psychotherapy session, but I think having that rock solid inner foundation is really important for everyone, and particularly right now.
Yeah, and actually I found that most people I know do struggle with that inner side of themselves. And I think because maybe we don't realize the importance of the inner sense of worthiness and value, because I think the way life is, you know, life and achievements and social media and stuff is presented to us, we somehow assume that it's the external stuff that matters the most. So it's a big shift. But, you know, one of the simplest and most powerful tools I ever learned was the bi-directional relation, was based on this bi-directional relationship between how you feel and how that feeling is expressed on your physical body. In other words, how you hold and move your body. And when I say bi-directional, what I mean is that it goes both ways. In other words, if you feel happy, you naturally smile. Now, you don't smile because you're meant, because you say, oh, I feel really happy. What is that I do with my face again? Oh, yeah, I better pull my zygomaticus major muscle into a smile. You don't remember to. It's a reflex reaction. Because the positive emotional centres of the brain are connected in some ways to these smile muscles, this one here, and the one at the side of the eyes, the orbicularis oculi. I just like saying the name, it sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Not because anyone needs to know it, I'm indulging the fact I love the sound orbicularis oculi. Sounds like a character in a novel.
Yeah. Like a spaceman, a new Disney movie or something.
But similarly, if you feel stressed, again, you don't remember to tense your face in this corrugator supercilii muscle. You don't remember to do that. And you don't remember to tighten your jaw and remember to, you know, hunch your shoulders. Again, these things are reflex reactions because the outward expression on your muscles is connected to the circuitry of the brain that's processing these negative emotional states. You could think of it, a good analogy might be like a puppet on a string. So when you feel a certain way, it's like a puppet master pulls the appropriate muscles in that way. But this is where bi-directional comes in. Because if you recognize that happens, then you can adjust your posture, your muscles, your facial expressions, your breathing even, your spine, you know, how you hold and move your body. And that turns the puppet master around. And now it's your body that's controlling how you feel. And it's an such exceptionally powerful tool. I first got switched onto it when a friend sent me, when I was writing the book on it, on self-love, a friend sent me research on what is now called the Harvard Power Pose. And it was a professor called Amy Cuddy who had done this little experiment when she got people to stand like Wonder Woman or Superman for just 2 minutes. While having levels of hormones associated with stress or hormones associated with self-confidence and self-belief sampled. And amazingly, within just 2 minutes of standing like Wonder Woman, Superman, levels of stress hormone dropped substantially and levels of hormones associated with confidence and self-belief actually rose substantially. And the opposite happened for people. She asked people as a comparison to stand in a way that made that they would do if they felt lacking in confidence or self-belief. So like that, or fearful, you know, bite your nails or move your eyes, anything that you would normally do if you feel nervous or afraid or fearful. And stress hormone levels in 2 minutes spiked. And all the hormones associated with confidence and self-esteem dropped. So she wrote in her research that you can actually use your body to create how you want to feel. And when I read that, I thought, wow. So I really went to town. I did that every single day. That became my morning spiritual practice where I would stand like Wonder Woman. You know, sometimes I'd just get, no one's in the room, I'd stand like Superman, you know, and for 2 minutes, time myself. And then I'd walk around the room trying to find a way of moving and almost trying to program, this is how I will walk from now on in my quieter moments. I'll drop my shoulders a bit. I'll stretch my spine. I'll be conscious of my breathing because that helps my posture as well and it slows my mind down. And I literally relentlessly, over the next couple of months, I adjusted and corrected my posture relentlessly throughout the day, whether I was standing in the queue to a coffee shop or sitting in a seat or just walking to town or carrying shopping. It didn't matter. Relentlessly. Mm. But 10 times a day, maybe more, I would remember to adjust my posture and try to tell my brain this is how I want to feel. Now, a remarkable thing happens there because the brain, if you adjust any muscles consistently, the brain undergoes neuroplasticity in regions associated with those muscles. I mean, Harvard, great experiment, Harvard got volunteers to play 5 notes on a piano repetitively for 5 days and it literally grew the region of the brain connected to the finger muscles like a muscle. And so I figured that will happen to these muscles I'm exercising. And at the same time, the muscles associated with fear and anxiety and stress and worry or low self-esteem, I'm not using those muscles as much. So therefore, the neural centers of those will begin to degrade. And what I will get is a tipping point. And that was my theory, my hypothesis, if you will, that I would start to build the regions of the brain where of the muscles associated with feeling good on the inside, and reduce the muscles in, you know, the centers of the brain in the regions associated with low self-esteem. And if that was the case, then that would automatically have an impact on how I felt. And it literally, it was life-changing. Within two months, it was unbelievably life-changing. I've never gone back, because I've never gone back to the old posture, because the gains in how I felt on the inside, it was phenomenal. And I became so passionate talking about that, because it was, I didn't have to, you know, meet my inner child, and I didn't have to do any extensive psychotherapy work. And I'm not, please don't assume I'm knocking those. These are so valuable at particular times in your life. But for where I was at that time, the immediate thing that I needed was something powerful and fast that didn't take a lot of mental effort, because I didn't have the mental effort to put into it. I didn't have the headspace. I needed something relatively simple. And how much simpler than adjusting your posture, providing you do it often enough? You can't change brain circuits unless you keep doing something repetitively. So I knew I had to do this repetitively all throughout the day for a number of weeks to get it to stick. But literally, it was the most powerful technique that I've ever, ever practiced in my life for anything.
I absolutely love the simplicity of that. And I think it's an important point you bring up there about psychotherapy. Yes, it's an incredible tool.
Absolutely.
And I actually think a lot of people should engage in it if they can. But it can feel like a massive step. I mean, just even having the confidence to admit to yourself and other people, you know, I might need help here, or there might be something in my past or my present that I need to work on. But the simple act of changing body posture and having those almost immediate effects over a few months, and the analogy of a muscle getting stronger, hypertrophying, becoming more resilient, I really, really enjoy that. And that's something that, because I've watched a couple of lectures of yours, and that's something that you can actually see demonstrated on functional MRIs, with not only the physical changes, but the mental sort of visualization of it as well. Even if you can't get up, or you don't have the opportunity to stand in front of your mirror for 2 minutes, just the thought of it alone can be as impactful.
Yeah, in fact, one of the, you know, I've written, I've spoken a lot, even in sports coaching, you know, by suggesting, because there's a lot of research on if you repetitively visualize a movement. For example, a sports person who struggled with a particular type of, say it's a tennis shot, for example, if you relentlessly visualize that shot where you find your weakness, then your muscles not only get stronger and more adapted, but the neural centers of the brain undergo the same kind of change, even if you just imagine it kind of thing. And lots of research has been done in patients who've had a stroke that speeded up rehabilitation if they visualize again for at least half an hour a day, 4 or 5 times a week, doing movements that they're familiar with. So one of the things, I remember running a wee course on public speaking, and all I was teaching people was a wee bit about how to, you know, tap into your own self. But the main exercise was visualizing themselves on the actual stage. But not what most people do is you visualize the end result, people clapping. And I said, no, visualize from the moment your name is called and you're moving off the chair, and visualize your body language. Feel your shoulders dropping with relaxation, because normally if your name's being called, you start feeling anxious. So your body goes into anxiety mode, and your muscles will then make you feel even more anxious. So imagine dropping your shoulders, lengthening your spine, reducing your rate of walking to the stage. Imagine you're breathing comfortably. Now what you're doing is you're creating the emotional state associated with what you want to be. And then imagine delivering the first minute or two of your talk, not just what you're saying, but imagine how you say those things. Imagine the way in which you say it, the rate of speech. Imagine slowing down your speech and emphasizing particular points, and do that repetitively. And when you come to that situation, your brain will default into that, and that will come quite naturally. And the reason it works is because if you visualize something, in many ways, particularly if it's a muscle movement, the brain doesn't make much of a distinction between whether you're actually doing it or whether you're imagining doing it. There was, I mentioned briefly a few moments ago, but Harvard research led by a professor called Alvaro Pascal León, it got volunteers to play notes on the piano for 2 hours a day for 5 days. And they had brain regions, the brain scanned in the region connected with finger muscles, and there was massive change. But another group of people he asked to imagine playing the notes for the same 2 hours and five consecutive days. It's called kinesthetic imagery. And what you're doing is you're imagining how it would feel if you were playing the notes. So imagine, imagine looking at your fingers, that works as well. But in particular, imagine as if you really were playing the notes with your fingers for that 2 hours. And he scanned their brain as well. And amazingly, if you held the brain scan side by side of those who played the notes after 5 days, those who imagined, it's exactly the same. About a 97% pixel overlap if you count the area. Mm-hmm. But 97% overlap. In other words, in that exercise, the brain made no distinction at all between who played the notes with their fingers and who played the notes with their mind. So visualizing stuff in the brain, your brain, can be as if you really are doing the stuff, or as if the stuff is really, really happening. So that I use that as well for developing my self-esteem, particularly in situations I knew that I would tend to be feeling a bit anxious about or nervous about or feeling a bit shy about. And so I'd visualize myself for a week leading up to it, like five times a day. You know, yeah. it only takes a couple of minutes, but just mentally rehearse the thing. But not just rehearse the interaction, but rehearse how I will be holding and moving my body in the lead up to and going through that situation. And that's what you rehearse, not just the final outcome. Yes, final outcome, but pay more attention to how you develop, how you create that final outcome through how you're holding and moving your body. And that was so incredibly useful, particularly for those moments that I knew that I tended to be weaker on in terms of how I felt about myself on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, this is amazing that you've gone on this journey all from starting at a pharma company where you noticed the placebo effect, and that's where your interest lay from your earlier childhood experiences with your mother. I think most people think about the placebo effect in the context of pain and pain relief. Here is a sugar pill and here is a genuine paracetamol, and that there are similar effects. But the placebo effect, I think, can be well understood because, you know, we have natural pain relief chemicals that we release from our brain, natural opiates, endocannabinoids as well. What other instances can this effect be utilized and magnified? Because what you're talking about there is self-esteem, cardiovascular outcomes as well. There seems to be no end, but where do you think this impact of the mind-body connection can be best applied, if not everywhere?
It has huge implications, because if you dig into how the placebo effect actually works, then you see something similar impacting the entire body. Because ultimately, coming back to that example of pain, for example, when a person gets a placebo for pain, the pain goes away a lot of the time, not just because they're imagining it's going away or because they think it's going away. It's because the brain has actually produced its own natural version of morphine. So what happens is the brain has produced what it needs to produce to deliver what the person believes is supposed to happen. In other words, belief, and this is a much broader concept, not just belief, but even visualization and other things, it causes the brain to produce what it needs to produce to deliver what you are focusing on, whether you believe something, expect something, or even imagining it. And broadly speaking, that's kind of how the mind-body connection works. Like different emotional, say even visualizing, like visualizing the immune system, for example, like little piranha fish destroying pathogens and stuff, has actually been shown to activate and enhance immune function. So what's happening there? It's similar to the placebo effect. In other words, you're mobilizing the body's natural resources to deliver what you're focused on, whether the focus is a belief, an expectation, a feeling or an imagination. And even in some ways, it's very related to stress. When you feel stressed, you produce stress hormones. Not necessarily because you're in a stressful situation, but because of how you feel. Because two people can be in the exact same situation. One feels stressed and one doesn't. So the one who's feeling stressed will have far more adrenaline and cortisol than the other one. So it's not really the situation. I mean, out with really serious events where the nervous system kicks in, of course. But for most of the stressful situations in our lives, it's our perception of a situation more than the situation itself. But turn that around. And what about its opposite? Physiologically, the opposite of stress is kindness. It's how kindness feels. Some psychologists refer to it as elevation. Kindness feels like an elevated state. You help someone, it feels satisfying and it feels nice. If you observe an act of kindness, sometimes you feel moved or inspired. But globally, those are referred to similarly as elevation. Now, elevation, that feelings associated with kindness, rather than producing stress hormones because you feel stressed, they produce, I call them kindness hormones.
Yeah.
Really just to show that they're produced by the same overall mechanism. It's how you feel that generates it. Now, the main kindness hormone actually is oxytocin, the reproductive hormone, but that's not just a reproductive hormone. It has multiple roles in the body. It's actually a cardio, what few people know, very few people know, it's a cardioprotective hormone. And that means that it delivers some degree of cardioprotection. One of the principal ways it does it is by reducing blood pressure. To be more technical, it stimulates the production of nitric oxide and atrial natriuretic peptide. And so they do the business.
I just call it AMP.
AMP,
because
yeah.
I can't pronounce it properly.
Neither can I. So it produces nitric oxide and AMP, which does the business of reducing blood pressure. But oxytocin produces those things. So any state that produces oxytocin, therefore, will... I mean, the research in this began by noticing that women breastfeeding had lower blood pressure. And this was more than 20 years ago when the research was first done. And they realized that what was causing it was the production of oxytocin and therefore the nitric oxide and the ANP production coming out of that, all the research since. So in other words, being kind because of how it makes you feel is cardioprotective. Because it delivers, because of how you feel, delivers that ultimate, switches on that mechanism. Just like feeling stressed increases blood pressure. Feelings associated with kindness can have the opposite effect. This is why I call it an opposite. Kindness is the opposite of stress. But ultimately, what it really is a demonstration of is the mind-body connection. Here is a feeling, and the feeling is causing a beneficial physiological state. And we've known about this for, 100 years. You feel stress that produces these effects. It's only nowadays we're turning it around and saying, wait a minute, it's not feelings. Stress isn't the only feeling a person can have. And this is part of a large body of research like the placebo effect that shows that a psychological state of expectation or belief produces a neurological and also a physiological effect. Visualization, for example, produces effect neurological, physiological, and effects at the cellular level in terms of how muscle activity works. And even visualizing the immune system impacts immune function. So feelings associated with stress, feelings associated with kindness have equal and opposite effects. So what we're seeing is a large body of research now showing that how you think, feel, and believe does have effects. So the challenge in life then is, can I therefore and make sure that my mind and emotions are dominated with healthy in healthy ways, with dominant states, rather than reactively stressful things? It's not easy to do, but if we know that would be healthy, then it's, I guess one of the steps forward is let's figure out how to change your mindset so that the mind becomes more naturally able to, as you look through the landscape of your life on an average day, that your mind naturally settles more in the light than the dark, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it resonates with me so much because I think over a period of time, and I think because of my privileged position being in the medical field with supportive colleagues, a family, I'm able to appreciate all this and actually cultivate a sense of gratitude and positivity most days. But I think it's almost like we have to balance positivity with toxic positivity, which is a trap that I think a lot of doctors fall into, especially when they're faced with someone who's going through depression, anxiety, or things that we struggle to empathize with or understand. And I wonder if you could perhaps talk a little bit more about how we balance, you know, over positivity and actually letting negative thoughts sit with you, accept them, wash over you, and then proceed going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so important to not wash over. Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question, because it is easy to become obsessed with, I've got to be positive, I've got to be positive, I've got to be positive. And it's not so much like that. It's more about you're training yourself so that that becomes more natural. But in the process of it becoming more natural, you have to deal with the stuff that comes out and not push it inside, if you will. And there's a lot of research on how emotions can be lodged in the body. In the sense that, I mean, if you understand that there is a mind-body connection, then if there's an emotional state that you haven't dealt with, it would make sense that in some way, whether it's just through the stress effects in certain ways, that that could well have a counterpart in the body in some way that the body is functioning. There was some really cracking research on expressive writing. So this is about getting out what is inside. And what basically what happened is they found this technique. It was 4 consecutive days writing for 15 minutes a day. So that was all 15 minutes a day on 4 consecutive days. And there was a professor called James Pennybaker. And he's written, I think the book's called Expressive Writing, actually. He's a psychology professor. And he pioneered this technique, simple technique. And what he did, he got a group of people who would write for 15 minutes just about life. And they were compared with people writing about 15 minutes a day, 4 consecutive days, about stuff that they felt had traumatized them in some way. So whether it was a massive, you know, life-changing trauma, or whether it was just something milder, like just situations that being feeling hurt or dejected because someone's broken up with you or something else, and or any traumas and emotional challenges and issues that anyone has at a whole spectrum. 15 minutes a day writing just what happened, how you felt about it then, how you feel about it now, how it's affected your life. That was just the guidelines, really, just to help you to dive into it and get out of it. 4 days later, in a number of experiments, one of the experiments they did, they tracked medical visits to the medical centre. This was done initially with students, a couple of hundred students. They tracked over the previous 6 months and the next 6 months numbers of visits to the health centre. And there was a massive drop in health centre visits for those who'd literally spent 15 minutes a day expressive writing. In other research, they tried to track why that was, and there was a number of less stress, better positive emotion. But one of the things they tracked was a massive increase in immune function. One of the things they did, they gave people an endotoxin, exposed people to an endotoxin, you know, the harmless part of a toxin. And they found that the immune response to the endotoxin in those who'd done the expressive writing was, I think it was like an order of magnitude, whatever they measured, it was significantly higher than for those who hadn't done the expressive writing, but who for the same duration of time had written 15 minutes a day, but just about ordinary life events. So here was an immunological effect of having just got out of the system 15 minutes a day. So it's so important. So I love what you said about toxic positivity, because we end up thinking, I have to be positive all the time. But it's not really about that. It's like training a muscle. You're training yourself so that that becomes natural, not forced. And if in the process of it becoming natural, stuff will come up, and it's best to deal with it and not push it deep inside.
Yeah, I love all this research looking at specific parameters as well, particularly immune function. You know, it's quite simple to measure in serum, you know, the response to an endotoxin, and all the things that we're talking about with the mind-body connection would have been dismissed 20 years ago. Yeah. And you know, you're truly one of the pioneers of this, because you probably had undergone a lot of criticism throughout your career
initially,
up until this point. It's only until now that, you know, you have all these publications from distinguished institutions that validate a lot of what we've been thinking for many years. And it just stems a lot from, you know, ancient medicines, whether it be Chinese or Ayurveda as well. And I think, you know, this is really a suite of different medical interventions that we have. I like to talk about nutritional medicine and diet, but I think the aspects of mind-body medicine, exercise, sleep, hygiene, all these things can have a measurable impact on things like the immune system. And we need to be a lot more receptive to all these different ways. And I love the fact that you mentioned expressive writing, because I was having a conversation with a couple of specialists in migraine, and they're medical doctors, and they use expressive writing with their patients.
Really?
Who are suffering from migraine.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's one of the most positive tools that they've had with their patients. And it leads to anecdotal but demonstrable impacts on the frequency of migraines, which is fascinating.
Isn't that amazing? Wow.
Yeah.
It's great to see a real world application out with just the research papers. It's incredible that's being used. Because then obviously it's having an effect on what is triggering the migraine by just simply getting
absolutely.
Out. And it comes to, I created a wee model a few years ago called the four component emotion model. Like, we think of emotion or a feeling as just a feeling. But in actual fact, it's four components. You cannot disentangle the feeling from the corresponding brain chemistry. So there will always be a correlation between how you feel and what's happening in the brain. But you also can't disentangle how you feel from your autonomic nervous system. You know, the impact on your stress hormones, your heart, your liver, kidney. You can't disentangle how you feel from the ANS. In fact, I've got a little device, one that measures heart rate variability, but another that measures it's electrodermal activity. It's galvanic skin response. Basically, you put your finger in a wee plate and it measures the change in electrical current flowing through your finger, which is affected by micro amounts of sweat. So the micro amounts of sweat change the salt concentration, so that therefore increases electrical conductivity. Now, the micro amounts of stress, I'm talking micro amounts of stress, it's so sensitive to where your mind is. It's so sensitive that if you think you're thinking of something pleasant, and then your mind for a second goes on to something stressful or that makes you feel anxious, immediately it goes up, because the sweating, micro levels of sweating, changes the electrical conductivity, and the little line goes up on the screen. And so what that's demonstrating is your autonomic nervous system responding to how you feel, where your mind is. And similarly, what we've discussed already, you cannot disentangle how you feel from your muscles. So the four components of emotion are feelings, brain chemistry, and also body chemistry, autonomic nervous system, and muscles. And all four of them are connected at all four times. So therefore, not just will a feeling, like even a repressed feeling, cause your muscles to be naturally tighter most of the time, but it may well be that there's a counterpart in the nervous system that's also on alert and tensed up, for example. In fact, I read a book recently, The Body Keeps the Score, by Wessel van der Kolk, is it? One amazing, he's a trauma specialist, but researcher, The Body Keeps the Score. And he talks about some research that had been done on people and women who'd been abused early in life, and found that in that subset, it was a very small pilot study, that they found an abnormal ratio in the immune system. Like, the immune system still had a memory, was still responding to a memory, a threat memory. And so the immune system was always on alert. Most of them had an imbalance that was either causing an autoimmune condition or was related to an autoimmune condition, but very close to that. And they believed that it was due to this imbalance where the immune system was literally on threat. Even if you didn't emotionally feel that or physically feel it, it was like the body was feeling it on some way, and it was that threat was always there. And for some of the women, they had autoimmune conditions. I think they'd selected women for that kind of reason. And they were drawing this comparison, a possible correlation between having been abused in that way with autoimmune conditions. Obviously, you know, small study, you can't absolutely say that's a fact. I just wanted to mention it in the context that it might be evidence for the fact that how you feel might always have a physiological counterpart, even though you can't see it at the time. Just like the immune system, immune function increases, you know, improves when you do expressive writing. There might be well be more things that improve that we don't know about when you do expressive writing.
Well, this is, I'm really glad you did mention that, because I think certainly as physicians, we're almost afraid to pipe up when we have these anecdotes of people that we've spotted these trends in. And when you said that, it's brought up something, I don't know whether I've shared it on the pod, but I had a patient a few years ago who was suffering from an autoimmune condition. And I was talking to her, it was the end of clinic, so I had a little bit more time, because as you probably know, in the NHS we have about 8 to 9 minutes per patient. And we got talking, and I asked this question, you know, well, when's the last time you felt well? And we went through her timeline, and this poor lady had been the subject of abuse, and she'd had PTSD in her late 20s. And it was at that time, in the 3 to 6 month period, I think it was, that she was then diagnosed with autoimmune condition. And that was my anecdotal experience. Mm. And the number of times I've done that exercise again with other people who have very different conditions, but autoimmune as well, it's quite striking. And this has been sort of validated by a few of my other colleagues with their own anecdotes as well. But to your point, you know, it's really hard to gather all this information, to come up with a hypothesis and to test something like that without the relevant data. I mean, I need to probably look at Robert Sapolsky's work in a bit more detail. He's studied stress for his whole life. And I think there's certainly a manifestation of what we label as autoimmune conditions that have their roots in emotional distress.
Certainly that's where that section of the book was going, was pointing out that they've seen that so many times. That's why they did that relatively small study in concert with university academic departments. They did that small study because they'd seen it coming up anecdotally so many times in individual practices, that let's actually test it. Let's work with one of the major hospitals. And they looked at that particular ratio. And they what they were suggesting is there was a correlation between, they didn't go as far as saying causal, because you don't know yet until you test more. But they said there was definitely a correlation between the autoimmune condition and the abuse at that early stage in life. You know, and I think the advantage of knowing these areas of research is that maybe can help. There might be some people who can benefit with some, maybe psychotherapy, maybe some other deeper techniques that might well have an impact on autoimmune conditions. I don't know of any research that's looked into that yet, because it's as you know, in science, it's difficult to draw a causal effect, but it might well be that release of emotion, because certainly when it elevates immune function in response to an endotoxin, you might find for some people, and I don't know, you know, you wouldn't be hard to predict who these people are, but you might find that balance that's linked with autoimmune conditions might well stabilize itself as the personality is somehow able to stabilize themselves in some way.
Yeah. It's strange, because I really want to ask you a bit more about kindness, and I recognize it's quite a strange time to be talking about kindness given what's going on with the civil rights movement and protests, and I believe that there is an appropriate time for anger and demonstration, but I'm also a firm believer in the sort of minuscule actions of change which is initiated with thought and that coalesces into, you know, a massive shift in compassion and the way we function as society. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about the multiplicity of kindness and how contagious it is. Not to talk about the virality and nature of it, and excuse the pun, but
One of the things that I find fascinating about kindness is it is highly contagious. In fact, it's the most contagious thing. Researchers at Harvard and Yale, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, did some research where they found that kindness ripples outwards like a pebble dropped in a pond. You know, if you drop a pebble in a pond and it goes out and you see the waves rising and falling and moving out at the other end of the pond, a wee lily pad does that and it's waving up and down, and you think, why is the lily pad waving up and down? Well, it's because of the pebble. But the pebble is
just for the listeners, David's doing a bit of a body pop.
I'm doing a swaying shoulder movement here. I'm simulating as if I was sitting on a lily pad and I'm going up and down. But the lily pad's going up and down because of the wave. But what created the wave was the pebble dropped in a pond. Now, that's a really good metaphor. That's why they call it the ripple effect. It's a very good metaphor for kindness, because kindness is the pebble dropped in a pond. And what Fowler and Christakis did is they tracked the waves. And what they found is, if you be kind to someone, that because of how you make that person feel, that person will be kind or kinder to someone else because of how you made them feel. Now, that someone else is called one degree of separation from you, one social step away. But that person will be kind or kinder to someone else because of how they made to feel. And that's 2 degrees of separation. But that person will be kind or kinder to someone else because of how they feel. And that's 3 degrees of separation. That's the lily pad now at the far end of the pond. But it's not just one lily pad. It's many, many lily pads, because this is where the R number comes in. Because one of the things that Christakis and Fowler did in that paper, and if you look at some other research, you can see that the R number for kindness is somewhere between 4 and 5, and actually nearer to 5. In Christakis and Fowler's, it was 4. Given the constraints of that piece of that research. But in actual fact, if you look at other stuff, it's probably closer to 5. And what that means is, when you're kind to someone, because of how you make that person feel, and I'm talking to any listener today, if you do something kind for someone, if you were to follow them around for the rest of the day, which I hope you don't, but if you had to, what you would notice is, because of how you made that person feel, whether grateful, relieved, satisfied, inspired, moved, whatever, that person will likely be kind or kinder to 5 people over the course of the next rest of the day, over the course of the next 24 hours, because of how you made them feel. Now, that's the R number, 5. Now, each of those 5, that's at 1 degree, at 1 social step from you, 1 degree of separation. Each of those 5 will be kind or kinder to 5 further people. So that's the second wave going out from towards the lily pad. Now, that's 25 at 2 degrees of separation. But each of those 25 will be kind or kinder to 5. And now that's 125 lily pads from a single pebble. It's 125 people from a single act of kindness. And obviously, that number, it will vary. It'll be higher for some people, lower for other people. Lots of factors, but on average, about 125 people. So the listeners today, if you do something kind for someone, it does not stop with that person. That person will absolutely be kind or kinder to more people as the day goes on, and each of those will be more. And you're setting in motion all these ripples. Now, the reason I say it's more contagious is, even at its peak, the R number for coronavirus was, 2.5, even at its peak. At 3 degrees of separation, that's 2.5. One person infects 2.5, who infects 2.5, who infects 2.5. So that's 15.625, about 16 people at 3 degrees of separation. But kindness is 125. So the R number tells you how exponential it is. So kindness is far, far more exponential than the coronavirus. And it's a nice way to think about it, because coronavirus hasn't reached every household, but kindness has. And that's just that just shows us, if you think about it, kindness is everywhere. Far more places than the virus ever got to. because it's so highly contagious, and it taps into our nature, our deepest, you know, the gene for the kindness hormone is one of the oldest in the human genome. It's 500 million years old and 4 days.
Oh, wow.
No, I'm only 4 days.
I had no idea.
Just joking. It's 500 million years old. It's had 500 million. All warm-blooded species have a version of it. And it's one of the things that keeps animals together. Animals come together and they socialize, they play. And it's related to that because the gene is so old, so ancient. It plays such a vital health role. And a role in social behaviour that's ensured the survival of all species to this point. And so in 500 million years, that's why it's involved in so many different parts of the body. It's involved in the cardiovascular system, the immune system, even involved in the creation of neurons like neurogenesis. It's involved in cardiomyogenesis, the building of heart muscle cells. It's involved in building our bones and our skin. It's involved in digestion, gastric motility. It plays many, many important roles, even rebuilding blood vessels, angiogenesis. It plays huge numbers of roles in the body, the kindness hormone, which suggests that all of these functions in the body respond to being kind. So not only is it contagious out in the world, it's contagious inside your own world, inside your own body. It has multiple effects. Being kind have multiple health-giving effects in yourself.
I mean, if that wasn't an advert for being kind, I'd
buy kindness here.
And that really does resonate with me quite a bit, because I always like to think about the evolutionary perspective of why we are like we are, like why, for example, fasting might have benefits, and why we have evolved to be a cooperative species, because it is literally inbuilt in our genomic code, and it's necessary for survival. So that's I think that's a brilliant way to sum up our conversation. Honestly, that was super inspiring.
Oh, for me too. It's been great just chatting with you here. I've really, really enjoyed this chat.
Definitely. And there's so much more I want to talk to you about as well, actually, about, like, you know, whether psychedelics could have a role in conjuring kindness, particularly for those who have a history of trauma.
Yeah.
You know, whether it unlocks something, and even more about the mind-body connection. I mean, just what you were talking about there with the kindness woman and having, you know, a plethora of different impacts on different parts of the body. What are the kindness hormones beyond oxytocin? Are there any others?
Mainly oxytocin, but if you then follow it through, then because it triggers release of nitric oxide and ANP, I can even though they're not necessarily hormones, I just to keep the language as kindness hormones, I can refer to those as kindness hormones as well, even though they're not hormones. But it's just, you know, it makes it simpler if I just have one word rather than, you know, a kindness molecule, nitric oxide, NNO, and a kindness, you know, protein, you know, it's easier just for the language. But as far as the research goes, those are the three things that you can track. I mean, and then you can also see clear changes as a consequence of oxytocin. It plays a role as a very powerful antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. Mm. Research took cells from the cardiovascular system and cells from the immune system and put them under stress in the lab and measured high levels of oxidative stress, so free radicals, and inflammation of pro-inflammatory cytokines, and then did the same experiment but then introduced oxytocin. And in both the cardiovascular cells and immune cells, the levels of oxidative stress and inflammation massively, massively dropped rapidly in response to just doing the same stress experiment in the presence of the kindness hormone. In other words, when the kindness hormone's there, the stress on the cardiovascular system and the immune system is massively reduced. And that's roughly what the study was showing, is the effect of stress on the cardiovascular system and the immune system is substantially lowered at the cellular level when you have the kindness hormone there. And I think that's an amazing, you know, extension of what I was talking about as well. I just forgot to mention that earlier.
But please tell me you're writing a book on this.
I've written three.
Yeah, no, no, no. Yeah. Right, but specifically about the inflammation effect.
All right, well, I put it in one chapter. One of my books is called The Five Side Effects of Kindness. And I repackaged the word side effects because I worked in AstraZeneca, and a side effect is a negative side effect of a drug. Yeah. So I thought, I'm going to change the... A side effect is just something that happens alongside what you're doing. So one, it happens to be that one of the side effects of being kind is improved cardiovascular health, and it slows aging. And the anti-inflammatory effect is there in the cardiovascular system and in aging. In fact, some gerontologists refer to inflammation as inflammaging, because it plays such a central role in aging of the body in a number of different, not just outwardly, but a number of different internal systems. So I gathered together that research in The Five Side Effects of Kindness about the anti-inflammatory and the antioxidant effect of kindness. Also, I've got a book called The Little Book of Kindness, where I got that wee bit illustrated as well.
Nice.
I'm not trying to plug my books. I'm not really...
No.
You know, it's funny. I am the least salesperson. I feel very uncomfortable even promoting something that people have to pay for. I'm terrible at it. So
when I'm talking about
a book, I'm not trying to sell the book for my benefit. I'm literally saying, this is where you get the information. And it's, you know, if I read it myself, I would think it's a very couple of very good books. And I'm not... Only because there's nowhere else to get that information. That's all I mean. I don't know anywhere else other than looking through PubMed and research journal. I don't know where else to get that information other than, you know, and I gathered it together in the books because I thought it was so useful for people to have.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, we'll be promoting all of that for you, so don't worry about that.
Because I'm not very good at doing it.
What are you working on next?
I'm working... I've got an online community that I work a lot on and developing that. I do live talks every month, personal development, called Personal Development Club. And I invest a lot of time in creating video content and audio content for that, which is based on the needs of members, basically. And I'm also working on a book at the moment that's finding scientific evidence for stuff that people tend to be skeptical about, if I think the skepticism is knee-jerk or unfounded. So even some aspects of alternative health and lifestyle that people would tend to be skeptical about. And I'm building a scientific framework around it, because a lot of skepticism on things, even like the mind-body connection, is completely unfounded. I call it knee-jerk skepticism. It doesn't sound plausible. But when you say something doesn't sound plausible, it's mostly because you have no expertise in that field. And so what I'm doing is I'm gathering a large number of subjects that people think of in those kind of ways. And I've found some amazing, fascinating information, really. And it's worked really well with the fact that I'm halfway through a part-time degree in mathematics and physics.
I was going to ask, is that why you decided to do your degree in mathematics and physics, to sort of shape that framework?
Partly related, because I was starting to write a little bit when I was touching on things like quantum entanglement and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, I take my role as a writer and an educator very seriously. Mm. And when you have PhD after your name and you say something that's scientific, people consider you as an expert. And I worried that I might be misrepresenting that subject that I don't really know intuitively that well. It's just from what you read here and there and stuff. And I thought, that doesn't feel, for me, like I'm taking my role seriously. So I decided to do a degree in it. I'd been looking through a university text anyway on relativity, because I was exploring the parallels between Einstein's relativity theory and Tibetan Buddhism. Because Tibetan Buddhism have a theory of relativity. It's called dependent origination. But it's, in spiritual language, the equivalent of Einstein's mathematical relativity theory. And I was writing about that parallel. And I just didn't feel like I knew the science well enough. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to do a formal honours degree and study it. Heavy, it's very, very dense mathematics. I've just done an exam with covering quantum mechanics, relativity, Pauli exclusion principle, gravitational fields, electromagnetism. It was heavy going in the maths, but I love it because it's given me a depth of understanding of principles that I'd only just talked about because I'd read it somewhere in a popular science thing. But now my understanding of it is far deeper and far more intuitive, and there's less risk of misrepresenting the science. And that's really why I'm studying formally, so that when I say something, it's factually correct, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's not something that I've made an error with.
Absolutely. I completely concur with the same sort of fear of misrepresentation, because when you have doctor in front of your name and you are labeled as a medic who's, you know, done all their formal training plus their postgraduate level training as well, you're automatically seen as an expert. Yeah. Now, I'm a firm believer in that there's no such thing as an expert. There's just someone who's well read in a particular subject, right? And I don't think of myself ever getting to that stage where I'll ever be an expert, even if I spend the next 20, 30 years reading nutritional medicine or whatever.
I know the feeling.
But for those reasons, that's why I decided to do my master's in nutritional medicine at the University of Surrey, to prove to myself actually that I can actually talk about this with some degree of authority. Mm. And I'll be honest, I definitely suffer from imposter syndrome, and I steer away from sort of topics that I don't fully understand. And that's partly why I think I wanted to talk to you about the subject, because I don't really understand the quantum physics behind the theory of quantum healing. And I think it warrants a lot more attention, because I intuitively believe that there is something there that is worth studying, but I'm just not well read enough on the subject matter to put it out to the public from my perspective anyway.
Well, one of the things I've actually found in researching for this new book is evidence of correlations between people's mental and emotional states, regardless of the distance separating them. And some of the early work was done back in 1965 on monozygotic or identical twins, and found correlations in alpha brainwaves, no matter how far apart they were. This was published in Science. It's one of the top scientific journals in the world. It's the American equivalent of Nature, the premier journal. And it was based on some anecdotal evidence of identical twins who seemed to know when something had happened to the other. And that actually gave birth to a massive field that most scientists have rejected on the basis that it doesn't sound plausible. And the reason for that is because we're still in the mainstream wedded to the model that consciousness is inside your skull, and it's generated by brain science, brain chemistry, but there is no evidence of that. In fact, the philosopher David Chalmers refers to the hard problem of consciousness, that we don't know where consciousness, what it is or where it arises from. And a growing number of researchers and philosophers are saying, okay, let's play with the notion that maybe consciousness itself is fundamental. Mm. It's fundamental to reality. Maybe it sits even on a parallel with or beneath space-time. And if that was the case, then that might well introduce the possibility that identical twins, for example, could feel when something happened to the other. But then research since then, even up to last year, using computer learning to analyze EEG overlap traces, realize the phenomena isn't just present in identical twins, but to anyone who shares a strong enough emotional bond. Did it with long-term partners that was correlated with the quality of their relationship. With mother and daughter was another strong, even functional MRI, looking at MRIs, when if the emotional bond was strong enough, if one person was startled, the MRI picked up a change in the visual cortex. If the person was visually startled, the MRI of the other half of the relationship picked up a change in the visual cortex at the instant their correlated partner was stimulated. Wow. And now, last year, there was a paper published by computer scientists and statisticians using machine learning, sophisticated machine learning, to analyze EE overlaps and found astonishing correlations in these types of experiments. In other words, there is a connection between people at a distance. And that immediately opens up the idea. There's lots of research on distant healing, sending healing to people, even prayer. Mm. And it doesn't necessarily have to be religious prayer. If we dispense with the notion that it's, say, that you pray to God and it's God doing it, and turn it around and imagine that it's something to do with your consciousness, then you can see statistically. In fact, the head of the chairman of the American Statistics Association, Jessica Utz, former chair, actually spoke about this phenomena at the annual general meeting to 6,000 statisticians in 2016. And said she was worked for the US government during the Cold War and under the Secrets Act was not allowed to talk about it. But now she can, and she said the data is compelling and it would be widely accepted if it pertained to any other field of science. But because it relates to a field of science that people are skeptical about, most people reject it on the notion that it doesn't sound plausible. So I've gathered together a lot of that research in one chapter of the book as an area of stuff that people tend to have knee-jerk skepticism about. And I've introduced how it works. I've gone into a little bit of the physics of not saying it's physics that explains it, but there is an obvious correlation between the phenomena. And therefore I'm suggesting in the book, the phenomena is probably related. This entanglement between states of consciousness and two people at a distance is, there's a parallel with quantum entanglement. I'm not saying quantum entanglement is the cause of that or is what's happening, because quantum entanglement doesn't pertain to information traveling, but there's a correlation between there's an obvious parallel between the phenomena. And so what I've done in that chapter is describe quantum entanglement and describe entanglement of conscious and unconscious states and say there's an obvious parallel. Doesn't mean they're the same thing, but maybe they both arise from a deeper fundamental aspect of nature itself. And that's what...
There's so many themes there that I think... I mean, you're really brave for tackling the subject, because I think it definitely needs to be tackled. I think the skepticism arises from a number of different sources in medicine. A, you're trained to be a very, very skeptically minded kind of person throughout medical school. You're also trained in an almost military-like behavior to not step out of line. Yeah. And with reason, because there are some erroneous medics, and we have a history of people just doing whatever they want without the bounds of evidence-based medicine that at least unified and made treatment accessible to everyone and fair as well. But then, currently I'm reading a book called The Emperor of Maladies, which is a biography of cancer. It's by Siddhartha Mukherjee. An incredible read. It's quite weighty, and it's basically chronicling how we used to think of and treat cancer over the last couple of hundred years, if not beyond that, actually, because he talks about Byzantine and all different types of areas. And it's absolutely fascinating how dogmatic people were, even within the medical field, and how we almost throw skepticism insults willy-nilly if it doesn't fit with our own theories or our own sort of belief system. And so I can understand why so many people have this knee-jerk skepticism.
Me too.
And it's absolutely fascinating. And you should definitely speak to Jeffrey Rediger, who's studied what he describes, what other people describe as miracles in medicine. We have spontaneous remission. And a lot of what you just talked about there, the thoughts, sending prayers, it's amazing just how many parallels across different stories spanning different conditions have the same sort of foundations. I believed in healing myself, or I ate this certain way, or I concentrated on these sort of lifestyle practices, or I cultivated gratitude. And I think it really does warrant attention.
Yeah, so definitely. It's one of the reasons that I'm writing on this. And I have to say, one part of me feels excited, because I think it's subjects that people intuitively know there's something there. And I've taken the scientific part of the book very seriously, but I've also suggested to scientists and skeptics to lay off people that you, just because you think you know more about the world and you're more intelligent than someone who maybe talks about a crystal, for example, you know, have a wee bit more compassion and understand that we're all coming from the same place. We're just trying to make a difference. It doesn't matter you know, I'm suggesting in the book that we be a bit kinder to each other, and that's the best way to go forward. But I have to say, another part of me feels really nervous about writing this book, because I've built up a lot of credibility over the years because I'm writing about important things and I back up everything with science. But I'm now venturing into some subjects that are met with more scepticism. Maybe where I was 20 years ago when I first started to write on the mind-body connection, it was, people were very sceptical, and I did get a bit of criticism from former colleagues back at that time. You know, I remember being forwarded an email by a friend that was circulating among people I knew who were laughing at me for having left AstraZeneca and be in this thing writing, but try to write about the mind-body connection, and thought this was hilarious. Poor guy, you know, what a downfall for what was originally such a talented scientist. What a great downfall to be into this woo-woo stuff of the mind and all that. And so I feel like I'm going back to a place that I was in that I found very uncomfortable. And it was scary because I was struggling with my self-esteem. And it was scary, the insults that you got back then, and the attacks sometimes from people who are aggressively sceptical, even when the scepticism, again, is unfounded. But I feel like I'm venturing into the same territory again. I have to say, I feel scared a wee bit. And again, maybe it's another layer of self-esteem I have to work on, because I have been, you know, people do take what I say seriously, and I have built up a good reputation in the mainstream. And here I'm broaching subjects that more people are sceptical about, and I feel a wee bit worried that I lose some of my credibility, even though I've been very scientific in the book, but also that it'll be attacked by people who won't even read the book, who will just take the subtitle or a bit of text in the back, which often happens. And I don't know if my self-esteem has developed enough since I started working on it that I'll be able to handle that if it arises. And I'm just, you know, because we've been having this podcast conversation, I feel it's important to be honest here. And that's my honest position, as I flip between feeling excited about it to feeling very scared, and wonder if I'll feel fragile given the possible reception among people who probably won't even read the book, or will just take something out of it, misrepresent a chapter and laugh at it. And some parts of me are not quite healed yet and still feel fragile a lot of the time. People just don't see that side. But a lot of parts of me do feel fragile sometimes, and I feel a wee bit, honestly, nervous about the book. And I've never been nervous about a book for more than a decade, because I've always been in subjects that are more mainstream, like kindness and self-esteem, mind-body connection. Even my book, How Your Mind Can Heal Your Body, is very, very mainstream. Everything's backed up with science. Even though this book is too, I'm broaching into subjects that people are naturally more skeptical about. So being honest, I'm excited sometimes and fragile at other times about it. And I don't know how I'm going to be when the book comes out next year.
I mean, I'm so glad you talked about this, because I don't think people in the science world, like such as ourselves, talk about this enough.
Yeah.
And I was met with a ton of skepticism last year when my last book, Eat to Beat Illness, came out, and I was attacked by former colleagues as well. And they hadn't even read the book. Yeah. It was just the title, just the subtext, whatever. It's just, or just how it's represented in the media, whatever. And I think, I mean, it's really authentic that you're even, you know, admitting to yourself, let alone on the pod and everyone listening, that it's nerve-wracking. But I think that's almost like that negative energy that's also going to be converted into something positive as well. But it's almost like a really exciting time for you, just to flip it on its head, because you are almost like pushing your own boundaries and you're forcing yourself to be as authentic as possible, because ultimately this is what you believe in, and this is what I believe in as well.
And it's about being
almost like need people like you to put the homework in, to study it to within an inch of its life, and to present it in a format that everyone can actually understand, and it will help people as well.
I feel like it's important to be authentic, and my natural growth takes me into the spiritual aspect, what we normally think of as the spiritual aspects of life. And that's who I am. It's who I've always been. I've just not given as much attention to that side of me in writing and speaking for the last few years. And I can't help it anymore. I can't suppress it. It's just who I am, and it's coming out of me, and it's an area I have to move into more for me. And I always feel balanced. You see, I always need to find this balance. As that side of me is growing, I'm also pushing out into the heavy duty mathematics and physics. It's almost as one side expands, another side expands, so that I always find myself balanced, if that makes sense. I'm never too much spiritual or too much science. I always find a balance somewhere. And so whenever one side expands, the other side goes with it, if that makes sense. Why I think, if you think of it, that analogy, the mathematics and physics I'm going into is finding its balance with the expansion and the spiritual aspects of myself. So I feel like in honouring my growth, this book is way out of my comfort zone. But I have to do it, because sometimes the greatest gains in self-esteem lie just at the edge of your comfort zone. And I'm a work in progress, like I think everyone is. I, you know, self-esteem, you get to a point, but there's never an end point. It's like you said earlier about learning, and you're never an expert. You're always something new. So there's always new growth. And I feel now I'm at a point where the next level of growth is just outside my comfort zone. And so I have to do this for me. And even if it is met with skepticism and attack, if that does happen, I have to learn to stand up for myself, and I have to learn to deal with that better than maybe I have in the past. So on an underlying level, that's why I have to do this book for me.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, up until that time, I imagine you're just going to be working on building that foundation of inner self-esteem that keeps yourself
absolutely
rock hard.
Yeah, working on it now, actually. In fact, partly talking about one of the tools that I learned about building self-esteem is allowing yourself to feel vulnerable, but deciding that people's perception of you might even sound like you're weak or you don't know what you're talking about, that doesn't matter so much as how you feel about yourself, and it doesn't matter so much as the fact that you had the courage to say it anyway. And so part of me being honest now is embracing your own vulnerability and not being afraid to do it is a massive declaration of self-esteem to yourself, that even though people might be judgmental, I'm going to do it anyway, because this is who I am. And so I am practicing self-esteem right now in part of this conversation.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed this part of our conversation, to be honest, David. I feel like giving you a big hug right now.
Yeah, me too. Well, hugging you back, virtually hugging you back right now.
We could sense it. Yeah. And it's weird because there's so many parallels to our story, because my mum was ill when I was younger, and she went on her own sort of lifestyle medicine journey. She was very analytical about everything that she did. She improved her lifestyle and her diet and everything, but she also would have affirmations. Mm. She really honed her mind and her mental energy to focus on overcoming her condition, which is idiopathic anaphylaxis, a serious, serious condition. Mm. And that kind of inspired me to go into medicine. And then during medicine, completely forgot why I was in the first place, was very, very skeptical. And then I had my own health issues when I came out, and I was a junior doctor. And I had a atrial fibrillation, a cardiac issue, where my heart would beat, you know, 200 beats plus per minute irregularly, 2 to 3 times a week. And I was going to have the ablation, which is the conventional route. And my mum was the one was like, no, you need to focus on lifestyle and diet. And I was like, you know what you're talking about. This is, you know, woo-woo stuff. You can't mental health your way out of this stuff, like mindset your way out of this stuff. But I appeased her. And that's when I became, you know, a convert, because I overcame my own condition. Terribly, you know, it's an anecdote, and it's not something that I recommend that everyone just do without, you know, the blessing of the cardiologist, which is what I had. But it certainly put me on my path towards this. And I think very much the same way as yourself, although I feel like I'm further back on my own journey. You know, it's just pushing yourself forward and always trying to grow and expand. And enjoy, you know, the ride and practice kindness and compassion as much as possible along the way.
Well said. I could listen to you all day.
I really hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, you can find my guest at drdavidhamilton.com. The show notes are all on the Doctor's Kitchen. .com/podcasts. And if there are a few tips that I would suggest that, well, I'm definitely going to be doing them myself, but if you wanted to try them, it's finding a champion posture and practicing that 1 to 2 minutes a day. It sounds a bit silly, but I think from David's anecdotal experience as well as the research behind it, I really am going to put that into practice. Visualization is actually something I've been trying to do more often over the last couple of years, and actually taking time to visualize exactly what a good day looks like, what a good reaction looks like, or even what your life plans out to be like over the next 5 or 10 years and what you actually want to achieve. And as always, meditation, breath work, or just trying to find an exercise that helps you cultivate inner stillness in today's busy modern world. I'm also going to put some of the links to the books that we talked about on the show notes, thedoctorskitchen.com/podcast. Remember to subscribe, give this a 5-star rating if you enjoyed it, and I'll see you here next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.